With the Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello and welcome to the reading of the Courier Journal for Sunday, September 25th, 2022. As always with our reading of the Courier Journal, we start with the weather from the First Alert Storm Team on your side. Today we have a high of 79, mostly sunny and windy. Tonight, we're looking at a low of 57 and a starry night. On Monday, we have a high of 74 with a low of 49, mostly sunny and pleasant. On Tuesday, a high of 69, a low of 46, mostly sunny. On Wednesday, a high of 67, a low of 48, partly sunny. On Thursday, a high of 71, a low of 50, pleasant and sunny. And on Friday, a high of 73, a low of 56, partly sunny and nice. In the local forecast, mostly sunny and windy today. Tonight, a starry night. Mostly sunny and pleasant tomorrow with breezy in the afternoon. Tuesday is mostly sunny. Wednesday is partly sunny. Thursday, pleasant with plenty of sunshine. And Friday, beautiful with sunshine and some clouds. Looking at the almanac, the highs and lows, and this is Louisville through 4 p.m. Saturday, the high and low, 78 and 59, the normal high and low, 79 and 59. The record high was 96 in 2010, with the record low of 39 in 1989. Precipitation 24 hours through 4 p.m. Saturday was 0.06. Months to date was just a little over 2 inches, with the normal months to date at a little under 3 inches. The year to date, 36.45 inches. Normal year to date, 36.27 inches. For pollen, it looks like we're in the moderate in weeds and molds, with grass and trees being absent. The air quality yesterday was in the good range, as it is today. Sun and moon cycles, sunrise, 7:33 a.m., sunset, 7:35 p.m., moonrise, 7:06 a.m., moonset, 7:47 p.m. We're scheduled to have a new moon today, the 25th, with the first on October 2nd, the full on October 9th, and the last on October 17th. And in a little bit of weather history, on September 25th, 1994, violent thunderstorms in western Pennsylvania produced damaging hail. Golf ball-sized hail accumulated 8 inches at Arthur Dale, Pennsylvania. Moving on to our front page, there are a few main articles. The first, A Common Goal, Revitalizing the West End. The second, Primary Care Doctors Fleeing Kentucky. And the third, Dealing with Russia's Tactics. We'll start with that first article, A Common Goal, Revitalizing the West End. And this does include a few photographs. The first, as the caption reads, left, two row houses are being renovated into restaurants for businesses connected to Chef Space on 18th Street in Louisville. And another shows a group of 20 or so people standing smiling at the photograph that says, what happens when a who's who of Louisville join forces? And this article is by Bailey Loosemore. The 44-member list reads like who's who of Louisville's politicians, business people, and philanthropists, all brought together around a unified mission, revitalizing the West End. There's Charles Booker, a candidate for U.S. Senate, Steve Poe, a well-known developer, Howard Holloman, a former manager at GE Appliances, and Rob Locke, executive director at the Regional Habitat for Humanity. There are representatives from the University of Louisville, Norton Healthcare, and LG&E, plus the city's Chamber of Commerce and some of its largest corporations, Brown-Forman, Yum Brands, Papa John International. When they first met at the 2014 Bingham Fellows class, few in the group knew each other well, but 8 years later, many have united to become a powerful force responsible for shepherding millions of dollars into the predominantly black, low-income area. Today, their accomplishments are visible in vacant homes that have been brought back to life, new structures filled with much-needed businesses and programs that are helping black-owned companies grow, most notably through a nonprofit founded by class members, One West. The work built on momentum had been growing for years, members said, but I credit the Bingham Fellows with making it real and putting some teeth to it so that it can actually happen, said the Reverend Jamisa Ferguson, senior pastor at St. Peter's United Church of Christ, who participated in the class. Not everyone, however, sees the changes as progress. Some residents feel the Fellows have exploited their neighborhoods, and as money continues to pour into the West End, they worry outsiders will reap the benefits over long-time residents. I'm not saying they shouldn't be at the table, Martina Kunnick, president of Neighborhood Planning and Preservation, an advocacy group, said of Bingham Fellows class members, but they shouldn't be building the table at the head of the table and telling us how lucky we are to be at the table. That needs to change. The Bingham Fellows program, founded by Leadership Louisville, was started in 1988 as a way to gather community members around the region's most critical issues. In 2014, nothing seemed more critical than reviving the West End. 2 years prior, back-to-back homicides in Parkland during Mayor Craig Fisher's first year in office had shocked his administration into launching new anti-violence initiatives. And in 2013, a 38-page exposé in Louisville Magazine called on the city as a whole to do better by the historical black area, shaped over decades by racist practices that drove businesses out of the neighborhoods and prevented families from building generational wealth. It was because all of these series of negative events that we felt we needed to do something, said Ferguson, who also serves as CEO of Molo Village, a nonprofit developer. We just didn't know how we were going to do it. Leadership Louisville heard the appeal and soon announced the topic for its next fellowship class, Investing in West Louisville's Path to Prosperity. The goal with each Bingham Fellows class is to bring together community leaders who can move the needle on an issue, including those with personal experiences and those with resources to address it, said Cynthiana Kapnick, president of Leadership Louisville. When you mix the two, that's part of where the innovation comes in, she said. Already, the Louisville Metro Housing Authority was applying for a federal grant that could be revitalized to use Beecher Terrace, a dilapidated subsidized housing complex in Russell. And once the fellows were selected, they discussed how they could leverage community projects as part of the application. It was the perfect storm, said Gretchen Milkman, then director of advanced planning for the city and a member of the class. We were all kind of doing different things, pulling us all together in that group, like you're doing this, I'm doing that. We started to connect the dots, which is what made it successful. The class members eventually narrowed their focus to three fields: early education, employment, and development. The education team worked with Metro United Way to install little free libraries throughout the 40210 zip code, where just 35% of children were kindergarten ready. The employment team established the West Louisville Connectors, a network of West End leaders tasked with informing job seekers of available opportunities. And in what has become the class's most successful and most controversial act, the development team created One West. 8 years into its life, One West has raised more than $10 million in contributions, including receiving $1.3 million from Metro government since 2015. The nonprofit has spent nearly $1.3 million purchasing property along the 18th Street corridor between Broadway and Muhammad Ali Boulevard, where it is restoring the historic Royal Theater as a commercial hub and turning two formerly vacant homes into a restaurant incubator in partnership with Chef Space. And it's opened the Plan Room, where Black business owners and employees receive training and mentorship with the goal of increasing minority representation in the construction industry. When you think about what's been done in a 7.5-year time frame, it's jarring and it's unbelievable, said Katina Whitlock, Louisville's former director of community services, who now works at GE Appliances. In an interview with the Courier-Journal, Whitlock and three other Bingham fellows who remain board members at One West say none of it would have happened without tireless volunteer work from class members, as well as support from the city's major businesses, financial institutions, and foundations. Let's just face it, the resources that are needed to help bring back West Louisville are outside of West Louisville, said Holloman, who recently retired from GE and grew up between the Russell and California neighborhoods. We had to get people outside involved to see this, to invest in the effort here. That mindset, however, has rubbed some residents the wrong way. Sean Spencer, president of the West Louisville Dream Team, said she takes issue with One West receiving funding over other West End organizations that have proven track records, such as the Louisville Central Community Center. And she feels One West has not been transparent about its spending, including making clear what it intends to do with properties it buys. It's not what us as citizens want, she said. Whitlock admits One West founders might not have always adequately communicated with residents about its work, but she said the nonprofit intentionally invited members from each West End neighborhood to sit on its board and regularly ask residents for feedback. Board members are not paid for the work they do with One West, according to tax filings. We don't view One West as something that is happening to people in these neighborhoods. It's something we are doing with the people in these neighborhoods, Whitlock said. Maria Hampton, a board member and advisor for the 2014 Bingham Fellow Class, said the nonprofit needed capital up front to deliver on promises it made to the community. Plans and proposals had gone nowhere before, leaving residents frustrated and untrusting, said Poe, the developer and board member who has negotiated several real estate purchases on behalf of One West. Some things are going slower than we would like, he said, but I think we are achieving the results that we set out and promised from the beginning. From her second floor office, Ferguson of Moa Village can look out on the newly constructed Beecher Terrace, where hundreds of families and seniors have already settled into their homes. Her building itself opened within the last year, a nearly $8 million complex filled with Black-owned businesses, nonprofits, and other amenities long missing in Russell. It's called the Village at West Jefferson, and Ferguson said it wouldn't be the asset it is today without the connections she made through the Bingham Fellows, including to classmate Johanna Roberts, who was hired to lease the building. It gives me a sense of pride, Ferguson said of being in the class. Other 2014 Bingham Fellows agree. There's a running joke that each class is better than the last. But even more than that, they can see the fruits of their labor beginning to bloom, and they don't plan to stop planting seeds for revitalization anytime soon. We wanted something that was going to be a lasting idea, said Diana Porter, a Jefferson County Public Schools board member and participant in the class. Not just do a project, do a presentation, and go home. We wanted something that would be a long-term and meaningful to the community. Yvonne Smith, CEO of One West, said the nonprofit estimates it will need $50 million to take its programs to the next level, where it could construct new retail space and help West End businesses build equity, but it will need support from local, state, and even federal entities. We cannot do it in silos, she said. We must do it in collaboration with one another. One West board has proven that it works when we all at the city lean in and work together. The fellows have made missteps over the last 8 years, several acknowledged, including not doing more to involve West End residents in decision-making. But if the West End is to flourish alongside the rest of the city, Ferguson said community leaders must keep trying to make lasting change. This is just the beginning, she said. You can't do in 7 years what has been undone in 75. It takes time and it takes endurance, and we have to keep pushing to make sure that this is completed. Our next article, primary care doctors fleeing Kentucky. Kentucky is losing primary care doctors faster than it can replenish them, leaving much of the state with shortages that could make residents' well-publicized health issues even worse. The reasons for the shortfall are a myriad, observers say, including the COVID-19 pandemic resulting in more retirements and doctors being drawn to higher pay and specialized fields. But the trend has left most of the Commonwealth's 120 counties, 94%, with a shortage of primary care providers. That's because every Kentuckian should have one, said Emily Beauregard, executive director of Kentucky Voices for Health, a nonprofit advocacy group. That's the provider you should go to when you're seeking preventative care. It's the provider that you should go to first whenever you're sick, whenever you're managing a chronic illness. Experts say primary care doctors can help people get ahead of health problems before they turn into emergencies, and the shortage is exacerbating problems in a state that already ranks high in the nation for diabetes, death, heart disease, obesity, and cancer, among other things. And while the state has a big gap in primary care in rural areas, more urban areas, like parts of Jefferson County and its neighbor Bullitt, have shortage areas as well. Experts say part of the solution is investing in educating physicians in and from underserved areas. We're trending in a dangerous direction here if we don't have a big intervention soon, said Ashley Gibson, the director of workforce development with the Kentucky Primary Care Association, a nonprofit that promotes health care in the underserved areas. She noted that 40% of Kentuckians live in a rural area, though only 17% of the state's primary care doctors practice in those areas. And why doesn't Kentucky have enough primary care doctors? A 2016 University of Kentucky study found that the state ranked 40th for its primary care workforce. But during COVID-19, the state's ranking worsened. In 2021, it ranked 44th. Federal data shows Kentucky had only 418 more primary care doctors in 2016, the latest year for which such information is available, than it did in 1999, and repeatedly has had less than many of its neighboring states. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention data show the Commonwealth consistently had more total primary care doctors than West Virginia from 2009 to 2013, but fewer than Indiana, Tennessee, and Ohio. Kentucky had 2,696 primary care doctors in 2016. That's roughly 6 per 10,000 residents. This isn't the only state to be impacted by primary care shortages either. In 2020, the Association of American Medical Colleges predicted that by 2033, the nation would be short between 21,400 and 55,200 primary care physicians. To hit the national median by 2025, UK said Kentucky needs to add 237 physicians every year, which outpaces its estimated annual influx of 116. That could be difficult because more than half of Kentucky's medical school graduates leave the state to work, Gibson said, explaining, "We just can't afford this talent migration." Why graduates leave the state isn't completely clear, said Molly Lewis, interim CEO of the Kentucky Primary Care Association, said it could have something to do with students being from other states and moving to Kentucky only for their education. If you're coming in from out of state, then you probably need even more inducement to stay here instead of going home, because you're going home somewhere else. Lewis said another issue is the draw of specialized medicine, explaining, primary care just isn't able to be that competitive in terms of helping doctors make a life and offset tremendous bills for student debt. Health Grades, a company that provides information about healthcare providers, reported in May that specialists earn about $368,000 a year, roughly $108,000 more than the $260,000 earned by primary care physicians. Gibson added that she believes COVID-19 accelerated retirement plans for many people. We are just in a critical time of need to improve the pipeline, to strengthen the pipeline, to get more primary care physicians in our state, she said. How many Kentuckians have a personal doctor? About 74% of Kentuckians said they had one person that they think of as their personal doctor or health care provider in 2020, down from 76% in 2019, according to CDC data. That percentage has stayed in the 70s range since 2013. Ideally, that number would be 100, Lewis said. We know that people who seek preventative care and are up to date on their care are overall healthier and that their overall health expenses are lower. If you can shoot for 100%, then you're creating access to primary health care, then you are reducing the need for more expensive types of health care services because you're able to diagnose, treat, and prevent poor health outcomes. Lewis said babies and children generally have primary care doctors, especially during the time when they may be required to get vaccines or checkups for schools and sports. The numbers trend down for adolescents and young adults, she added, and pick up again for the Medicare population. Primary care providers are really the point person for the healthcare system, or at least should be, Beauregard said. These doctors can coordinate your care and make sure that we're not just taking care of something when it's gotten serious, and when you've gone too long and now need emergency care. They make sure that we're as healthy as we can be as a state and individuals. Kentuckians can find the closest primary care office near them at members.kpca.net/map. Health centers work to meet community needs. Dr. Bart Irwin, the CEO of Family Health Centers, a nonprofit that operates health centers in underprivileged areas around Jefferson County, hasn't been immune to challenges presented by the shortage. It's been difficult for us, almost impossible for us, to recruit physicians, especially family practice physicians, he said. That's partly because family health centers can't pay as much as hospitals, he said. The physicians the group recruits are often retired for paying back federal scholarships by working in the nonprofit health fair. Family Health Centers provides care for more than 43,000 people in 2021, most of whom lived in poverty, were uninsured, lacked transportation, or spoke a different language, Irwin said. Their centers are located in underserved areas on purpose and meet language needs, offer transportation help, and have a sliding fee scale. The patients we serve probably put healthcare needs off as long as they can, Irwin said. And then when they finally do get to the extent where they have some significant problems, if they're not able to access care, then I think a lot of times they just kind of give up in trying to get good care. If people don't get proper help in time, he said, their conditions could worsen and they could end up hospitalized or in need of complex specialty care. So I think it's important that we have the adequate staff available to them to see patients when they need to be seen. Beauregard said Kentuckians often can't find a doctor in their network or have to wait longer and drive further than they should to access primary care, among other challenges. She said Kentucky needs more thorough and regularly updated data about providers in the state so legislators can address workforce development needs effectively. Areas could grow their own doctors. To rebound from the shortage, we really need a radical intervention, Gibson said. Part of the solution she and Lewis suggested is investing in medical education at the community level. If you look at Kentucky, 120 counties, Most all of them have a need for primary care providers. And who better than somebody who has grown up in that community and knows the community really well, Lewis said. That's why the state needs pipelines to get Kentuckians educated, trained, and put to work in their own community, she said, adding that improving the pipeline that helps graduates transition to careers would be really helpful. When we expose students early in their education to health careers and we provide support along the way, it really works, Gibson said. That can include high school shadowing opportunities, clinical rotations for medical students, and even residency-level instructions. The association advocates for funding for teaching health centers so that health centers can operate their own residency program, she said, which really supports that pipeline and gets them trained in that, settling in their communities so hopefully they stay and practice in those communities. And that article was by Sarah Ladd, and you can reach out. She is a health reporter at sladd@courier-journal.com, or you can even follow her on Twitter at lad_Sarah. We have a few minutes left, so we're going to try to squeeze in some letters to the editor. The first is Mike Suttles, Louisville 40217, Education. Indiana is racing Kentucky to get to the bottom in education. The state of Indiana has one of the richest governments and one of the poorest levels of education of all 50 states. With an excess of several billion dollars of tax money, our Governor Holcomb speaks with pride of a joint effort with the Lilly Endowment to spend $111 million for literacy improvement. Of course, this $111 million, the Lilly Endowment is providing $60 million. It's interesting that a private firm is spending more than our state for this vital segment of Indiana's public education. The reason for this level of integrity is promoting education is the lack of education itself. With a serious shortage of teacher because of a long history of insufficient salaries, we elect our top public officials, governor, and legislature, who will spend $1 billion of our tax dollars in an obvious and despicable purchase of votes. Indiana's present tax refund could have paid enough salary to attract teachers who presently must find other careers for better salary. Our next one is entitled Food Insecurity, and that's by Macy Fusen, Prospect 40059. The effects of COVID-19 and climate change on global food insecurity are devastating. As a student at Assumption High School and a person who believes in the dignity of all people, regardless of geography or national origin, I believe that the United States should take steps to lead the world in addressing issues related to global nutrition. That's why I'm calling on my elected official to ensure robust funding levels for food assistance budgets, accounts including Food for Peace, Feed the Future, the McGovern-Dole School Feeding Program, and the Nutrition Subaccount. Additionally, I believe Congress must expand long-term food security programs, which are even more urgent in the face of COVID-19 and its ripple effect on hunger and malnutrition. Likewise, Congress should reauthorize the Global Food Security Act by 2023 and ensure that the updated legislation includes measures aimed at placing women at the center of efforts to address global hunger and malnutrition. And that was Macy Fusen, Prospect 40059. And that's all the time we have for the front section of the Courier Journal. Please stay tuned for the Metro section. Thank you for listening, and have a good day.
And now to continue the reading of the news from today's edition of the Louisville Courier-Journal for Sunday, September 25th, 2022. Your reader is Bill Sally, and we'll begin this half of the Courier-Journal news reading by reviewing today's obituaries and death notices. We read only the name, age, and location, if given. Richard Allen Ackerman, Sr., 91, Richmond. James Aulis Adams, 72, Akron. Ernest Sonny Anderson, 90, Simpsonville. Ricky Gijean Barr, 62, Louisville. Thomas C. Bolly, Jr., 76, Memphis, Indiana. Martha Virginia Brown, 80, Sacramento. James Clarence J.C. Buckman, 90, Lebanon. Francisco Bueno, 61, Louisville. Andrew Bush, 101, Louisville. Sue Ann Cajo, 75, Louisville. Rosanna Carmen, 71, Louisville. Lee Stanton Clore, Sr., 79, Crestwood. Kevin Cobble, 57, Lebanon Junction. Stephen Conaway, 66, Hanover. Gregory Michael Constantine, 66, Mount Washington. Joy Cornett, 86, Hazard. James Dale Crawfish Crawford, 62, Sweden. Faye Crumpton, 45, Salem. Mackenzie Delarue, 31, Louisville. Irma D. Denton, 97, Louisville. Barbara I. Deppen, 91, no location given. James Jamie Dowell, 57, Shepherdsville. James Eastman, 72, Richmond. Robert E. Eckenfels, Sr., 85, Louisville. Charles Robert England, 83, Shepherdsville. Sharon Epperson, 81, Louisville. Angie Daniel Hadley, Yurton, 54, no location given. Richard Ewing, 74, Louisville. Ewing Ann Fahey, 99, Louisville. Judy Fahey, 68, Louisville. Sister Marie Julie Fetcher, 98, Maple Mount. Lucille Fuchs, 80, Tell City. Jeffrey Wynn Glasscock, 60, no location given. Perry Wayne Harney, 61, Owensboro. Thomas Dennis Hart, 73, Louisville. Donald B. Hawkins, 62, Turner Station. Geraldine Jerry Heslin, 87, Louisville. Jackie Linnell Hooper, 90, Louisville. Tom Hopkins, 78, Shelbyville. Betty Hornbeck, 78, Elizabethtown. Lyle D. Houston, 84, New Albany. Barbara Katzman, 90, Louisville. Nat Kilburn, 74, Pekin. Clayton Herbert Kimmel, 82, Beachmont. Eric Lagerstrom, Jr., 48, Elizabethtown. Mary Lewis, 60, Jeffersonville, Indiana. William Marshall Lewis, 47, Bardstown. Teddy W. Lyons, 70, Louisville. Jack McCubbins, 70, Bloomfield. Ronnie Dean McDowell, 78, Brandenburg. Mary Ann Moran, 62, Louisville. Beverly J. Morris, 74, Louisville. Helen O'Connell, 91, Hardensburg. Marion B. Peterson, 97, Louisville. Dana Marie McCure Pettit, 66, Louisville. Noel Jean Phillips, 89, Elizabethtown. Donald Ray Phillips, Sr., 79, McLean County. Earlene M. Sanders Pickett, 70, Louisville. Stanley W. Lump Ponder, Jr., 51, Louisville. Imogene Mills Riley, 76, Barberville. Robert H. Roth, Jr., 87, Louisville. Norma Pauline Rowan, 87, Upton. Jackie Hopper Shadowin, 92, Bowling Green. Teresa L. Souders, 56, Elizabethtown. Douglas Glenn Tate, 59, Louisville. Donald D. Thompson, 89, Louisville. Nicey Thornton, 49, Louisville. Kenneth Lee Vick, 52, Central City. Van Eric Whaley, 60, no location given. George Bud Whitworth III, 62, Louisville. James Maurice Wilson, Jr., 26, Louisville. Babiejo Winfrey, 41, Louisville. Francis Joan First Warner, 88, Louisville. Michael S. Woods, 73, Louisville. If you'd like any more information about any of those listed in today's obituaries and death notices, there is a site you can visit. It is courier-journal.com/obituaries. Again, that site is courier-journal.com/obituaries. The next article in today's edition of the Courier-Journal is entitled, McConnell, Sinema, will discuss bipartisanship at U of L lecture. This article is written by Morgan Watkins of the Louisville Courier-Journal. Arizona Senator Kristen Sinema, a Democrat who has faced criticism within her party for sometimes helping Republicans stymie progressive legislation, will join Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell at the University of Louisville on Monday morning to give a lecture on bipartisanship. The 10 a.m. event is hosted by the McConnell Center, which Kentucky's longtime Republican leader founded over 30 years ago, along with university officials. It isn't open to the public, but people can watch her speech live on YouTube. Sinema and West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin often have been thorns in the side of many in their fellow Democrats since their party won a razor-thin majority in the Senate in early 2021. That's largely because their votes have been crucial to determining the fate of some Democrats' highest priority legislation, and sometimes they've withheld that needed support. Sinema and Manchin's steadfast refusal to get rid of the filibuster, a 60-vote threshold the Senate must meet to advance most bills, has had especially high consequences. It has allowed the McConnell-led Senate Republicans to block major Democratic proposals, such as a bill that would have made significant changes to federal elections and expanded access to voting. Last year, McConnell said he's admired the duo's courage in defending the Senate as an institution. It isn't unusual to see Sinema on the Senate floor chatting with McConnell, who voted for the $1.2 trillion bipartisan infrastructure law she co-authored last year. Sinema has stuck with her party on certain big votes, though, like the Inflation Reduction Act, which authorized a big historic initiative to deal with climate change, as well as steps to reduce prescription drug expenses for Medicare patients, among other things. Sinema's lecture in Louisville is entitled The Future of Political Discourse and the Importance of Bipartisanship. The McConnell Center gives U of L scholarships to Kentucky students and hosts events like Mondays that have featured government officials of both parties. The next article is entitled Courier-Journal Preserving Photo History. Library Going to U of L Archive for All to Access. This article is written by Billy Coben of the Louisville Courier-Journal. To ensure future generations can look back on defining moments in Louisville's history, the Courier-Journal is donating its library of an estimated 3 million photographs and negatives to the University of Louisville Archives and Special Collections. The Courier-Journal, winner of 11 Pulitzer Prizes throughout its 154-year history, was joined by its parent company, Gannett, in donating the collection, which is being appraised and is expected to be worth tens of millions of dollars. This move will allow the public access to the collection, which chronicles history in Louisville, as well as Kentucky and the nation. The collection includes images from daily happenings and major events from approximately the mid-1930s to the early 2000s, when digital photography began to replace the use of film to capture images. The collection might have dated back further, but Louisville's Great Flood of 1937 destroyed much of the Courier-Journal's photo and negative library. This gift will allow the Courier-Journal to retain the legacy of our work through this collection of historic photographs, Courier-Journal editor Mary Irby Jones said. It is important for us to preserve and share our work with others so our community can learn about the history of Louisville as captured through our photographers in the field for more than 150 years. Members of the Bingham family, which owned the newspaper from 1918 to 1986, have made a separate donation to U of L to help preserve the collection, prepare it for public use, and develop programming around it. The combined generosity will generate the Barry Bingham Jr. Courier-Journal Photograph Collection, interim U of L President Lori Stewart Gonzalez said. The collection's millions of photos and negatives will nearly double the holdings of the U of L photographic archives. We are incredibly grateful to the Courier-Journal, Gannett, Emily Bingham, Molly Bingham, and the rest of the Bingham family for making this historic gift possible, Gonzalez said. Generations of readers saw these photos in their daily newspaper each morning, and now future generations will continue to be able to study and appreciate the insight they provide into the history of our city, state, nation, and world. Emily and Molly Bingham said they were pleased to take part. For most of the decade, it's been our dream to honor our father by finding a permanent public home for the Courier-Journal's photographic collection, they said. This visual treasure is a testament to his dedication to high-quality journalism, his passion for photography, his love of archives, and his commitment to public access to information. He's up there somewhere today, smiling and joyfully twirling his trademark handlebar mustache. The Courier-Journal is selling its downtown office building at 525 West Broadway and wanted to ensure the collection was housed in a safe place. Among the thousands of photo prints and negatives are compelling images from the Civil Rights Movement, the 1970 mining disaster in Hyden, Kentucky, integration of Louisville Public Schools, the deadly Carrollton bus crash in 1988, and historic prize-winning Kentucky Derby photos, Irby Jones said. The Courier-Journal is honored to entrust this priceless archive to the care of the University of Louisville for the purpose of making the collection available to the community for research and scholarship, Irby Jones said. Besides the Civil Rights Movement and the Kentucky Derby, the collection chronicles World War II, quote, presidential visits, changes in the built environment, and numerous public appearances and behind-the-scenes images of world leaders and celebrities, said Carrie Daniels, Director of Archives and Special Collections at U of L. Basically, all of the changes happening within our country were captured in these photographs. Elizabeth Riley, photo archivist at U of L Libraries, said the volume of photos and negatives in the collection means it will take years to organize. It's an incredible collection, she said, but we hope to make a portion of the collection available online in the near future. Digitizing, and more significantly, creating the descriptions that are necessary in order for photographs to be found online, takes time, but it will make the collection accessible to everyone who wants to see it. Riley praised Barry Bingham Jr., the third and last Bingham family member to serve as the paper's publisher, for setting high photographic standards. The Courier-Journal won 2 Pulitzer Prizes for photojournalism during his tenure. He was a huge supporter of high-quality photojournalism, Riley said. He grew and improved the quality of photography in the newspaper as print photo techniques improved with time. That commitment to quality is reflected in the collection and endures in the images we see in the Courier-Journal today. Pat McDonough, who has worked as a photographer at the newspaper for 39 years, said the collection is, quote, truly a unique, one-of-a-kind pictorial history of Kentucky. The Courier-Journal has a long history of great photography, and now it is being saved for future generations to enjoy and explore, McDonough said. I've had many sleepless nights over the fate of the archives, and I'm thrilled that it's now in a safe place. C. Thomas Harden, who spent 28 years as a photographer and director of photography at the Courier-Journal and at the Louisville Times, said the collection is, quote, really a first-rate gift of history for this region, the city, the county, Kentucky, and all of its 120 counties, as well as southern Indiana. The Barry Bingham Jr. Courier-Journal Photo Collection Endowment is seeking additional contributions to support the organization, digitization, library services, and public programming involving the collection. To contribute, or for more information, contact Denise Bond at Denise, D-E-N-I-S-E, dot Bond, B-O-H-N, at Louisville.edu. The next article in today's edition of the Courier-Journal is entitled, Court Rules Walmart Shoplifting Case is Not a Felony. This article is written by Billy Coben of the Louisville Courier-Journal. The Kentucky Supreme Court ruled Thursday a woman who shoplifted about $80 worth of items from a Walmart self-checkout station should not face a felony that carries 5 to 10 years in prison, a punishment that Attorney General Daniel Cameron defended. All seven justices instead agreed with the Kentucky Court of Appeals, which had said it was, quote, inherently unfair to convict somebody of a Class C felony for theft of goods worth $80. And the Supreme Court sent the case back to Pulaski Circuit Court, where a jury had initially found Chastity Shirley guilty of, quote, unlawful access to a computer. Shirley, 34, will now likely receive a directed verdict, which would see her felony conviction dismissed in court. While shopping in 2018 at a Walmart in Somerset, Shirley pulled what retailers call a, quote, switcheroo, by switching the barcodes from a toothbrush holder with those from a more expensive children's rug and slipcover before checking herself out of the store. A loss control associate caught her, and the cost difference between the items she paid for and the two items she tried to take was $80.80. She also allegedly, quote, pushed and elbowed a loss prevention manager as she exited the store, but was later found not guilty of a fourth-degree assault charge at trial, the Supreme Court noted. Instead of charging her with a Class B misdemeanor, the standard for shoplifting crimes involving less than $500 that in Kentucky carries up to 90 days in jail and a $250 fine, a Pulaski County prosecutor persuaded a grand jury to indict Shirley for, quote, unlawful access to a computer, which is a Class C felony punishable by 5 to 10 years in prison. For context, theft cases can reach the Class C felony level if they involve property valued between $5,000 to $10,000. The prosecution and Walmart contended that when Shirley misled the self-checkout scanners, she was tapping unlawfully into the sophisticated computer system connected to them. But the Court of Appeals said the crime didn't meet the statute's definition, using a computer without its owner's, quote, effective consent. Shirley and millions of other Walmart customers have the retail giant's permission to use its self-checkout scanners to pay for merchandise, the appeals court reasoned. In Thursday's opinion, written by Deputy Chief Justice Elizabeth T. Hughes, the Supreme Court agreed and found the, quote, Commonwealth did not present proof that Shirley accessed Walmart's self-checkout register beyond the consented to barcode scanning for completion of a self-checkout sales transaction. Without that proof, it was clearly unreasonable for the jury to find Shirley guilty of unlawful access to a computer in the first degree, the opinion said, citing similar findings from courts in other states, such as Oregon. The circuit court erred by denying Shirley's motion for a directed verdict of acquittal. The justices noted the case presented them with the first interpretation issue of the, quote, unlawful access to a computer in the first degree law, or KRS 434.845, since it was amended in 2002. The law reads, quote, "A person is guilty of unlawful access to a computer in the first degree when he or she, without the effective consent of the owner, knowingly and willfully, directed or indirectly accessed, caused to be accessed, or attempts to access any computer software, computer program, data, computer, computer system, computer network, or any part thereof, for the purpose of A, devising or executing any scheme to artifice to defraud, or B, obtaining money, property, or services for themselves or another by means of false or fraudulent pretenses, representations, or promises." Focusing on, quote, "effective consent," which is not present under Kentucky law if, quote, "used for a purpose other than that for which the consent is given," the Supreme Court noted that, quote, "Walmart emphasized that it cannot and does not consent to consumers using self-checkout registers to commit fraud and steal merchandise." But the Supreme Court found the, quote, "effective consent statute," quote, "speaks to the purpose for which the user was granted access to the computer, e.g., a shopper granted access to scan items." With the context of the statute being computer access, the owner's consent would be related to that, not the fraudulent purpose a bad actor desires to achieve, the Supreme Court opinion said. After a jury found her guilty in 2019, Shirley accepted the state's recommendation of a 5-year sentence pending a pre-sentence investigation. She spent 203 days in jail and was then, indeed, sentenced to 5 years in prison. But the sentence was later suspended, and Shirley was instead placed on conditional discharge for 30 days, the court noted. Pulaski Commonwealth's attorney David Dalton, whose office had prosecuted Shirley, told the Courier-Journal on Friday that he, quote, "respected the Supreme Court's decision, and we will follow it." Stephen Buck, the assistant public advocate who represented Shirley, declined to comment and said he had not been able to reach the woman for any reaction since Thursday's ruling. Buck previously wrote in a brief that in pursuing a felony conviction for a, quote, "petty theft" of a, quote, "paltry sum," Cameron's office and the Pulaski Commonwealth's attorneys had, quote, "abandoned both common sense and empathy." Walmart Media Relations did not immediately respond to a request for comment, and the $347 billion company did not previously say whether it had asked Kentucky prosecutors to charge self-checkout shoplifters with the more serious crime of unlawful access to a computer. A spokeswoman for Cameron, the Republican Attorney General, did not immediately return an email Friday morning seeking comment. His office had previously said if the Court of Appeal ruling stands, circuit courts will be bound by precedent and have no choice but to find that retailers give consent to misused self-check scanners. Self-checkout theft has become more and more common. One study found shoppers are 4 times more likely to steal from a self-check terminal than a human cashier because it provides the illusion of anonymity, and it is so easy. Most of us feel ashamed of getting caught by a fellow human trying to steal something, Shad Maruna, a professor of criminality at Queen's University in Belfast, previously told the Courier-Journal. Removing the human eyes and replacing them with technology makes the process seem less shameful. Experts such as Christopher Andrews, an assistant professor of sociology at New Jersey's Drew University, an author of The Overworked Consumer, Self-Checkouts, Supermarkets, and the Do-It-Yourself Economy, say shoppers feel justified because retailers are using the devices to eliminate jobs. Other consumers persuade themselves they deserve 1 or 2 items for free because they have to bag their own purchases and check out themselves. In one survey conducted by a coupon company of 2,634 shoppers, nearly 20% admitted to having stolen at a self-checkout. Half said it was because detection was so unlikely. The next article is entitled, "How Kentuckians Can Find a Primary Care Provider." This article is written by Sarah Ladd of the Louisville Courier-Journal. Experts say being established with a primary care provider is a crucial part of living healthy and preventing health problems from worsening. Kentucky has a lot of areas with primary care shortages, and not everyone has a person they think of as their primary care provider. Here are a few ways to find primary care in the state. Primary Care Association State Map. The Kentucky Primary Care Association has a map of primary care clinics throughout the state. Check out the map at kpca.net for more information. If you're on Medicaid, Molly Lewis, interim CEO of the Kentucky Primary Care Association, said there is some patient choice for people who have Medicaid, but there are also assignments. Patients will have a card, and they'll have a number, and they can call and know where they're intended to go, who's waiting, with open arms for them to come to that particular provider, Lewis said. Next, Louisville's Family Health Centers. Family health centers offer preventative and primary care to many underserved populations in Louisville. For a list of locations, visit adultprimarycare-familyhealthcenters at fhclouisville.org. Again, that's fhclouisville.org. To make an appointment at a location, you can call 502-774-8631. Again, that number is 502-774-8631. The next article is entitled, Pope Calls for Saving Planet, Finding Peace. This comes from the Associated Press. Pope Francis, visiting Assisi in Italy, the birthplace of his namesake saint who was close to nature, called on Saturday for courage in abandoning fossil fuels and lamented that older generations didn't know how to protect the planet and secure peace. He told young people he was pinning his hopes on their efforts in working to save the planet and make the world's economy more attentive to the poor. During his brief visit to the hill town in central Italy, Francis spoke to a gathering of some 1,000 young people, some of them young economists. Other attendees included those involved in efforts including startups and focused on helping the environment. The participants came from all over the world. Among them was a woman who recounted to the Pope how she and her husband were helped while fleeing Afghanistan after the takeover of the Taliban last year, by an organization called the Economy of Francis, which is inspired by the life of St. Francis with his intention to the poor and others in need. This wraps it up for the reading of the news from today's edition of the Louisville Courier-Journal for Sunday, September 25th, 2022. Your reader has been Bill Sally. Thank you for listening, and now stay tuned for continued programming on Radio I.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.